Whip.
All right, I think we're all right again now.
Okay.
Just make sure that this is all right, yeah.
So when you don't hear something, that means you're all right. If you hear my voice, that means you're all wrong.
No, I can listen to the tape through this.
Okay.
But what this is telling me is what's on the tape. There's a delay.
Oh, I see.
So I'm hearing like an echo in here, but I hear what's on the tape and not what's coming through here.
All right, well.
So, I apologize. We'll sort it all out.
Okay. Well, I hope that most of it got through.
Yes. Oh, no, we've been doing very well. It's just that the moment I put that tape in and I looked at the number, it didn't make sense. So
okay. That's
why I just decided to put another one in and we'll sort that out. What was one of your more difficult acquisitions? Something you wanted and it took you a long time or was hard to find?
Okay, well, I can answer that. What springs to mind is, let's see, there were, do you know Martian Land in New York City? Very ritzy, high-priced book dealer. Pretty much in the style of H.P. Krauss. I bought some books from H.P. Krauss too, but they were always sky high. But sometimes you have to spend a sky high price in order to get the book, which you can't find anywhere else. So anyway, they had a set of Jonathan Hill. I've got to get this right. It was Jonathan Hill. He put out a catalog quite a few years ago, in which he'd come across a little cache of very early books. I believe he bought them from some monastery in Bavaria. He'd been over there and they'd sold him a whole lot of alchemy books, 16th and very early 17th century alchemy books. And he had about, I think, 7 or 8 unfindable books by Libavius. And I'd never even heard of all of these books. And as usual, caught me with my financial drawers down. I've got to have these books. I can't afford them, so I did order, I think, about 5 or 6 of them. But the one I really and truly wanted had gone to Harvard. Anyway, I did order the other ones. And to answer your question, the one I really wanted was kind of like a glaring gap. So, the ones I did manage to succeed in getting are now fortunate at CHF. Now I have 15 different editions of Libavius's work. They're all terribly rare. Okay, so then about 2 years after that, Martina Lamb said, and we were talking, her name is Sayla, I think it's S-E-Y-L-A, she's from Turkey. Sayla Martin said, I do have a book by Libavius, might just be interesting. So she sent me a description. It was a very book I missed from Jonathan Hill. So we negotiated a price, beautiful copy, and actually a little tiny bit cheaper, not by a few hundred dollars, cheaper than Hill's copy. So I plugged that little hole. Now, talking about plugging holes, you know that the first so-called, they call it the first textbook of chemistry, is Libavius's Alchemia. And let me see, what is that date there? 1597. And there's also a sequel to it. The complete Alchemia comprises 2 books. One is called Alchemia, 1597, and also 1597, the Commentatione Metallorum, or Commentary on Metals. Well, wouldn't you know it, Offenbacher comes out with a catalog. I was in South Dakota at the time. It always happened that way, it seems. I was always somewhere, you know, so I was not near a phone, or I couldn't write a letter or something like that. But anyway, I called Jean and said, did we get anything in the mail today? She said, yeah, you've got a catalog from Offenbacher. So I said, read it, please. So did you read the catalog? And I said, no. Yeah, yes, more on that. And she said, she came to my baby and said, Alchemia, 1597. And I said, how much? $3,000. Oh, my gosh. Anyway, I said, well, I wonder if I can wait until I get back 2 days later. So I I had no way of calling from there because I was way up in the boondocks. And of course, in those days, cell phones didn't exist, and I was basically incommunicado. I was just calling from my motel room anyway. So I thought, well, I bet you Bill Coles grabbed that thing, because I know he was after that as well. Even though he concentrated between us about 1700 and 1850 roughly, he wasn't allergic to buying a key book if he could find one and could afford it. Well, it turned out that Bill, and I was right, Bill had in fact grabbed that book, and I looked off and bothered, and he said, no, Bill Cole bought it, and so on. Anyway, it turned out when Bill described his copy, it was only half of the book, because sometimes that particular book was bound in two volumes. Just like, because the second part had its own title page, and you, to all intents and purposes, it looked like another volume. But the way you could tell it was issued together is because on the verso of the title of the first part was the table of contents of the second part. And you don't do that unless it's one volume. So I thought, my God, he's bought me half the volume. Good. So several years went by, perhaps 7 or 8 years went by, and finally Emil Offenbacher came across another copy. And I don't remember exactly what the price was. It was about $6,000 or $7,000. It was a lot of money. Back in the, I suppose, late 70s. And so he offered it to me. He said, you know, Bill bought the other copy, but this has got the extra one. Pointed out the fact that the table of contents describing the second part was on the verso of the first title page. And he hadn't even realized it at the time. With the other copy, because he had noticed it or something. So he offered it to me, and would you like this, Roy? So I worked out a time payment and got it. Now it's CHF. It's a book of legendary rarity. It's a fantastically rare book. And it's the kind of big, famous item. So CHF has now got the first edition of both parts, lovely copy and so on. And, well, I don't know, I've got lots of little tales I can tell you about individual books, but Oswald Krall, I got about with Krauss, he offered me a copy of the first edition of 1609, I think it is, of the Basilica Chimica, and my copy that I bought all years before had a somewhat slightly mutilated title page. Damp had affected the top part, and it was just plain missing, it just damp and fallen off. But most of the title page was still there. It's a beautiful and great title. But they came along and they were offering this book for $6,500. Now, remember, I already had another copy in beautiful condition, except for the slightly defective title page. I thought, gosh, $6,500. I'd only paid perhaps $900,000 for the other one. So I wrote to them, and this, by the way, had been sitting for about 4 years in four different catalogs. Obviously not moving. So I said, well, would you please send it to me? So they did. It wasn't quite as good a copy. The title page was intact, but the rest of it was kind of dull and a little flecked and spotted and overall kind of a grayish looking copy. So I said, look, it's really not worth that. You've had it for at least 4 years, maybe five. Would you take 5,000 for it? We're not in Krauss. Oh yes, let me go and we don't normally do this, very uppity. So anyway, a minute of holding on the phone, and came back. No, the price is marked. No, we don't. Despite the fact I dealt with these guys for about 25 years, weren't cut me an inch of slack. So I said, okay, I'll send it back. About a year later, they decided to sell it out of stock. And it went for about $1,500. What idiots. I mean, they could have got 5,000, I mean, but you know that. So somebody got it, and I don't know where it went or where it is now. It's nice to see this again. But I was very, very careful to carefully annotate. In some cases, I found so many references, I couldn't give them all, so I gave a selection. And usually my break-off, a cut-off point in a number of references was about 13 or 14, you know, or less, maybe 6 or 7.
One of the things I wanted to ask you was how you managed this collection, how you kept track of titles, how you kept track of...
Well, I can answer that. I had a little card pile. And what I would do, I had several card piles. First of all, I would handwrite the thing, so that was card pile set number one. Well, then that got to be two. I need a little, what, 3x5?
2x5 cards.
And that wasn't big enough. So then I went to, this side, whatever it is.
4x6?
Something like that, yeah. And I would just do the same thing as on the 4x5, but finally I thought to myself, look, why don't I just, by then I bought myself a copier, Canon copier, I just copy this off and glue this part on the front side and second part on the back side. And then I put everything in alphabetical order. And then I got all guitar was glowing, this Duco cement, and you know. I never heard of the almost glue wall before, so I was using Duco cement. I'm getting a high from this solvent. And I didn't like that, so I thought, it's not good for your liver and all that. So, but I did have a huge card pile built up. I dried these things outside, you know, let the fumes go. But finally I started using Elmer's glue wall. But then finally I thought, you know, much easier just to have a ring binder. So I went to the ring binder and forgot about the cards. So this is really, you might say, a third iteration in my catalogue.
Okay.
But
do you still have the cards, or did they...
Oh, yes, they're downstairs. Yeah, they're still there. But I tried to explain the difference between the first edition, say, for example, the large second edition of this important work and some additional plates. But I think that's a pretty straightforward. Now, some, like Bill Cole, tried to be a super bibliographer type, and I thought his catalog was so turgid and as to be almost unreadable. You know Bill Cole's catalog?
I've seen it.
He published it in 200 copies, and he inscribed one to me, but he charged me for it. He couldn't even give it to me, but I think it was $150, but I thought, well, heck, I better have it. So I paid him $150, and he wrote some nice inscription. It was kind of useful, but I found it, I think I did review it. Yes, I did review it. What's that now? It might have been in ISIS.
I might have it here. Let me look.
But I said, unfortunately, it has nothing to do with Boyle. Nothing mentioned. And I tried to be kind if he's still alive. I didn't want to damage with too much fame praise.
Here it is.
Oh, you got it. Great. You're going back so far, I can't even remember. Oh, that's it. Yeah. I try to be nice about it. But there is such a thing to be so nice. You know, you overkill. I said somewhere... I kind of wish I hadn't given that to CHF, because it's very hard to come by now. I suppose it always asks me back. I can't see where I referred to Boyle or that Boyle. Anyway, let's see. Oh yeah, I said, although his influence on the early 18th century was significant, sadly none of Robert Boyle's important chemical works are included, not even the collected editions edited by Peter Shaw, London 1725, second edition 1738, both of which I have, and Thomas Birch, 1744 and 1772. With this solitary omission, which is adequately covered by Fulton's bibliography of Boyle, I believe that Cole's bibliography will rank as one of the most valuable works on early chemical literature that has yet appeared. That was kind. It was. I learned a lot from that. Little catalog, but it's, let me see, yeah. Well, I thought it was a nice review, but I thought it would have been a lot stronger, but since he was a nice guy, and I tried to be kind. I'm sure that there'll be all kinds of reviews of my catalog that comes out saying, well, sadly, no, we didn't include this. And well, the reason was that either I couldn't afford it, I couldn't find it, or I didn't think that I had to.
You had to have spent an enormous amount of time.
Well, enormous, yes.
In doing this.
59 years.
And yet you kept your chemistry career going at the same time that this enormous collection is being built up too.
Oh, yeah. Well, I used to go and do my research, come home, have my dinner, and then spend at least 2 hours, writing articles on history of chemistry. I mean, really, in the beginning, I bought these books so I could have the original source material right at my fingertips. But you can't have everything. And even though I was buying background books, you know, books about books and so on, I quickly realized that what I was doing was impossible, really. And so I did the best I could. 59 years of it.
What would you say the rate of growth of the collection was?
Oh boy, it's hard to say. It varied. In the early years, it was very slow. It was a lack of money. I was still in training, you know. And during the kids' early years, you know, you had two little girls to buy shoes for and dresses and all that. And, you know, they outgrew these things very quickly. And my salary was not very good. And, you know, beach chemists don't make much money. And I tried to publish as much as I could, but I was in the kind of industries where they actually forbade you from publishing because they didn't want any trade secrets to go out. They said, if you want to publish here, you can get a patent on it. So we published by that means. But answering a question like the rate of growth is very difficult because it was very sporadic, that's all I can say. In the early years, it was pretty slow for the reason I've given, but once I stopped working for somebody else, started working for several clients instead of one, an employer who basically sets your standard living. I mean, you know, I went from about 30,000 a year way back in the early 70s to, you know, much bigger incomes, 3 and 4 times as much. It wasn't necessarily, it didn't come in like a regular paycheck, but if you look at it on a year-to-year basis and say, well, you know, I had a good year or a not so good year, but any year that I was a consultant working for myself was much more than I was making working with some joker. And at least I had stability, which I never had working for an employer.
How did you manage, how shall I put this? You have thousands of books now.
Yeah.
How do you manage, especially when you're spending this much money on a book, how do you store it, preserve it, house it? Did you have them in your home?
Yes.
They were in your home.
Well, I know.
Did you have them insured?
Funny you should ask that. Years and years ago, when we got back to California, I decided, you know, we had pretty much all our money tied up in these books. Not much in the bank, not much in real estate. And so I approached various insurance companies, and I think I ended up with Fireman's Fund, and I gave them a typewritten list of the books and their values, the amounts I paid for each book. And we totaled them all up, the whole thing up, and I believe it came to something like $338,000 or something like that. That was years and years ago. That's what I actually spent on.
That's the purchase price.
That was what I spent.
Okay.
I included the $15 books and the $50 books and maybe, you know, $200 or $300 books. Anyway, and then I did it again. I added an addendum to that. About another $300,000 or $400,000, and I was told we can't do that unless you take a gigantic deductible of like $20,000 or $30,000, which to me was a lot. That was quite a deductible. Or you store them in a bank vault, I go, what are you talking about? I can't rent a bank vault. So they basically, I thought, well, the heck with that. I'm just going to go on and just take a chance, which I did. So I never went past $338,000. And now the whole shooting matches at CHF. Because look, we're not smokers. We wouldn't allow smoking in our house because of allergies, and we don't like the smell of it. And we're not carousers, you know, don't have wild parties or anything like that. I believe, sincerely, I did have a theft. It was a unique manuscript of the man. It was the lab notebook of, the world pattern type China. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've forgotten the man who invented that, but there was all his experiments on cobalt compounds to create that cobalt blue world pattern. And I'm not going to name the person. He was a New York dealer. He was a New York dealer who was associated with, we're not saying anything more. But I know that that book was there before he came. It was missing after he came. It was a polio too, it was about this tall, this wide, this thick. But he had a nice little briefcase, easily fit in a briefcase. And I went to show Arnold. Arnold came in about a week or so later. I went to right where it was. Now, I've never found it since. So he's disposed of that, I guess, somewhere, you know. But that really kind of ticked me off.
Is that?
I paid $10,000 for that book. You have to be so careful with some people.
Well, I was going to ask, is that uncommon in the book collecting, that you have to watch your collection?
Well, I usually sort of monitor people, you know, so I don't leave the room, for example. And or if I need to go to the bathroom, they come out with me and they say, well, why don't we take a break and, you know, you go to that bathroom, I'll go to this one. And because I'm always sort of, you know, careful about things, but I didn't expect an outright theft.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I shall not name this fellow, you can guess all you like.
No, that's fine.
You know this man very well, but I can't prove it. How can I prove it? All I know is before he came, it was there, and after he left, it was not there.
It's pretty strong evidence.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, take that to a lawyer, take that to court.
Right. No,
it's a he said, she said situation. So the only other case of bordering on theft that I had nothing really to do with, I bought a copy of Boyle's work. I don't know, I think it was 1673, one of those 1673 editions, through Warren Howell, and it had been stolen by some fellow in Chicago from the John Crowe Library.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you know about the story, but there was a big theft back in the 70s or sometime in the 70s. Anyway, I met John Warren Howell there, the book guy. He said, we're in trouble. He's a big man. He said, we're in trouble. I said, what did I do? Joking, you know, because I hadn't done anything. He said, you know that Boyle that you bought for me about a year or so ago? You've got to give it back. It's stolen. So he told me it had been stolen from John Crowe Library. Sounds all right. Got my money back, and I thought, well, you know, and now I've got to find another copy. So fortunately, I found another copy with an English dealer for about the same price, nice copy, and that is also at CHF. But that's the only, you know, outright dishonesty I've encountered. Although I understand people, you have to watch out, people stole from Stanford, you remember them? They stole from a lot of very rare maps,
mm-hmm.
and they found them thrown away in a dumpster behind a Safeway up in San Mateo. I mean, yeah, people are crazy.
The rare book collection at Penn had an original Ben Franklin, very small,
yeah.
very thin book, stolen.
Oh, gee.
And they actually didn't realize it, because there's so many books, until yeah. somebody went to look for the book,
yeah.
and there was a fake in its place.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out, and I don't know how much later, some book dealer called him and said, I think I have something you want, and somebody had tried to sell it to him. And it was somebody who worked in the library. And knew that this particular Ben Franklin was worth a rather large amount of money.
Well, I don't mind any kind of dishonesty. I'm always dealing very forthright and openly and honestly with everybody, because I'm not a very good liar, to be honest with you. You know, I tend to open up and probably say more than I should, and I know I trip myself up. If I lie, I'm going to trip myself up. But I always believe in honesty being the best policy. And I've never stolen a book. I don't expect anybody to steal from me, but it does happen. And it really infuriated me when I'm still kind of burning about that occasion. It happened several years ago. Not a long time ago, I should add. And I was getting ready to start cataloging my manuscripts, and I wanted to include that. I never tried to collect a lot of manuscripts, because I did have two Pasteur manuscripts. One was just a ordinary letter signed L. Pasteur, and then I bought a two-page document describing some chemicals, again, in by Pasteur, which I think has gone over to CHF. And I also, I'll tell you another little story too. There was when we first moved down in 1958 to Palo Alto, when I first joined Lockheed, I naturally scouted out the rare book scene in the Palo Alto area and in the Stanford area, and I thought, well, I came across a fellow called William P. Reeden, it's W-R-E-D-E-N. He lived in Athlone, long gone now. And I've been looking for this little book by Christopher Clayze, the English translation called The Complete Chemist, 1677. I walked into this old Victorian house, and right at eye level was this book. I couldn't believe it. It's been rebound, and I said, oh my God, and it was $70. I couldn't afford it. It was a large figure for me in those days, but I thought, I just got to have it, it's so rare. So I bought it. And then another one I bought was Michael Flood's book, The Utriusque Cosmi. You know that book at all?
No.
It's 1617. It's bound in another volume on the same subject. It's one of a series of seven volumes. You never find the seven volumes together, but they were spread out to about 1635, and they're all basically, you know, they're individual things, although it's part of a long-winded set. And I bought that for $90. And it's now at CHF. Very, very rare book. Worth many thousands now. I found a whole lot of other books, you know, like $5 and $10, and I had him put them away for me in a box. And Bill Cole had to go through town, and he lit on that, and he bought the whole box for me. I have money. Well, you can't blame. I was kind of long-winded in getting my act together, but and the whole lot couldn't cost more than $25, so I missed out on about five or six really nice early 19th century books. But talking of manuscripts,